MacCast, Sunday, February 25th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Another week, another bunch of Apple news and information and tips and tricks and things to get into. We got lots of things to talk about. It's not a super busy week, but a few things were going on. In this episode, we're going to talk about Apple fixing that Telugu bug, the Indian code character bug. Nikai still stuck on those OLED cuts. We're going to get into that. They're talking a little bit more about those. New devices may be arriving this spring. We're going to talk about which ones and when we might expect them or maybe not expect them. Apple is also been named the most innovative company of 2017, and Tim Cook talked about some of that innovation. So we'll get into that. And Apple Pay Cash looks like it's expanding into other countries possibly. And finally, people don't seem to be using all of the smarts in their smart home speakers. We'll talk about what that means and what it maybe means for HomePod as well. We've got all that plus the inside scoop on iPhone battery replacements. We've got some inside info to share with you. Also, an APFS imaging bug that you might want to know about, and how and why to use File Vault 2 on your Mac. That and a whole lot more in this episode. And we're not going to waste any time. We're just going to jump right into everything, starting off with this Telugu character bug fix. Apple released a series of updates this week, actually, to all of their operating systems to address this Telugu Indian character bug. If you missed that, that was the bug that was caused if you sent a certain Indian language character in a message to just about any messaging app on iOS, macOS, watchOS, or tvOS. I didn't even know there were messaging apps for tvOS. But regardless, if you got one of these characters, it could cause the app to crash. And in some instances, you could even get stuck kind of in this little crashing loop, because every time you'd go to reopen the messaging app, it would try to display that character and then crash your device or your Mac. Really annoying. Hopefully none of you got hit by that. But the updates to iOS, iOS 11.2.6, watchOS 4.2.3, tvOS 11.2.6, and macOS 10.13.3, which I think was labeled as a supplemental update. Those all came out this past week, and they address and fix those issues. So you're going to want to grab these updates as soon as you can. And we're going to have a note a little bit later for specifically iMac Pro owners about the 10.13.3 update. Actually, just macOS updates in general for iMac Pro owners. So stay tuned for that. Some users have also reported some odd issues after running the update with their AirPods, the iOS 11.2.6 update, that is. Things like the audio coming from the same channel coming in on both AirPods, or problems with actually activating and using the AirPod controls, the little tap gestures after running the update. It seems to be isolated and not too widespread, but if you have been hit by this issue, the fix is relatively simple. You're just going to need to unpair and repair your AirPods. To do that, you just go into settings, into the Bluetooth settings, select the AirPods, and then tap the forget device option. Once it has been unpaired, then you can just simply repair them again using the same procedure you used when you originally set them up. That involves putting both the AirPods back in the case and simply opening up the case near the device and then walking through the setup wizard, which will walk you through the process of getting them reconnected. And once you've done that, that should fix any issues that you might be having. And that's just a generally a good bit of advice if you run into any trouble with your AirPods. I've had to do that once or twice since owning them. So owned them over a year now, right? And had to do that a few times. Not too bad a procedure, pretty straightforward, and that should fix most issues. Some other software update things of note. This, with the latest developer betas, 11.3 and tvOS 11.3 developer betas, it seems in those that Apple has pulled AirPlay 2 support. The last update to developers included AirPlay 2 support, but it was kind of buggy and didn't work very well, so it looks like they have removed it in this go-around. It's a little bit disappointing because one of the key features of AirPlay 2 is the ability to stream audio to multiple AirPlay 2 devices at the same time. So if you have a couple of Apple TVs or AirPlay 2 speakers, you can stream audio across multiple rooms and it'll keep in sync. So it's a big wanted new feature that's coming. It's a little bit puzzling why Apple included it and then suddenly removed it. It might have just been a preliminary test to try and get some feedback from beta testers. And now that they have that, they want to work on it a little bit more before they put it back in. There's no guarantee that it's going to get back in 11.3, but we're going to have to wait and see on that. Another thing related to it somewhat is the fact that with AirPlay 2, or when that update for AirPlay 2 came out in the beta, it also added your Apple TV to the Home app. But now that they have removed the AirPlay 2 features, that means the Apple TV no longer shows up in the Home app either. So there's an integration that goes on there. And this removal has caused some people to ask what that means for the HomePod, the expected HomePod update to support multi-rooms with multiple HomePods. And it's really unclear at this point because that does rely, again, on the AirPlay 2 technology. And Apple has only said that it's going to come out later this year, that feature. So from my perspective, I expect that the AirPlay 2 features will return before the release of iOS 11.3, and it is expected that the iOS 11.3 update should come out sometime this spring. I'm thinking maybe in March, sometime toward the end of March, when Apple is also expected to be maybe doing some product updates as well. Usually they'll release a version of the OS or a new version of the OS along with new products, so I expect that to be the time frame, and I expect at that point AirPlay 2 will be released and also some of the updated upcoming features for HomePod, including support for multi-room audio and multiple HomePods along with AirPlay 2 support. So that should be coming. One last little odd thing with respect to software updates. Apple published a new support document noting that due to security changes being implemented in a future update on May 25th, that this is going to prevent first generation Apple TVs and PCs that are running Windows XP or Vista from using the iTunes store. So iTunes store support going away from those devices. Apple has also begun emailing users with active first generation TVs to warn them about the upcoming change. If you still have an active first generation Apple TV, you're still using it, that is amazing. I can't believe they're still working at all, and you will lose iTunes store functionality. I don't think you're going to lose any other functionality. Now that I'm reading this, though, it's interesting to note that they mention in this support article implemented changes coming on May 25th. So I wonder if that's a hint. I just mentioned that I think iOS 11.3 will come out toward the end of May. Maybe that's a hint toward the release date. I don't know. We may have just discovered something, or maybe not. I'm probably reading way too much into the tea leaves. But with that, that's kind of the latest on software updates for Mac and iOS. All right, we already talked about Nikkei and mentioned their report that Apple cut their orders of OLED panels, at least according to them, from Samsung by half, that they were expected to order about 40 million units in the first quarter of 2018, but cut those orders back to just 20 million. And they used that that information coming from the supply chain to speculate that that means Apple is not selling the iPhone X very well. And now they're continuing their doomsday reporting, saying that the cuts could be even deeper and that they've left Samsung scrambling to find replacement customers for their OLED products that they had ramped up for Apple, and now Apple has left them high and dry. And as you know, I don't buy 100% that the cuts are purely due to poor iPhone X sales. As a matter of fact, I don't even think the iPhone X is selling that poorly. Apple has been extremely positive about iPhone X sales, and as a matter of fact, Tim Cook mentioned at the last quarterly results call that iPhone X was the top-selling iPhone model every week since it debuted in November. That was up until the point that Apple had that call. So it had been selling very well, at least from Apple's perspective. Also, the iPhone X was named the best-selling smartphone in the world for the December quarter, by Canalys. So, there's a lot of contradictory evidence to show that the iPhone X is probably selling pretty well. And I think I already mentioned that it is typical for Apple to cut back on production and orders post-holiday season, but still the Nikkei claims the cuts are off of the estimates for first quarter shipments coming from Apple. So you have to ask, well, what does that mean? That either means that Apple doesn't need as many OLED panels or there's something else going on. Well, the something else could be the fact that we've heard other reports and rumors that Apple had been shopping around its OLED business. They were looking for other suppliers like China's BOE, and they had been talking to Sharp. A lot of those companies weren't ready to do OLED production. They were still kind of upping their game and adding new factories and facilities prior to the launch of the iPhone X. So it's presumable to think that maybe they have some deals going on with some other suppliers. And Apple certainly likes to spread around the orders for any given component on an iPhone because it helps them better manage their supply chain. It's something they really like to do. We haven't heard any concrete evidence that they've signed some new contracts, but that could be factoring into part of this. So I don't think we have all of the information. And as Tim Cook has classically said, you know, don't trust the supply chain because you don't really know what's going on with our businesses there. And even if there has been a reduction by Apple in the number of orders of OLED panels they're getting from Samsung, for whatever reason, the other issue that I have with this report is pinning the bad results on Samsung's bad results rather on Apple. You know, that Apple is solely responsible for Samsung's OLED business. In fact, Samsung could be partially to blame for their own decline in OLED revenues. The British research company IHS noted in a report that the number of OLED smartphone panels Samsung internally sources for its own products fell year over year in 2017. So Samsung is also buying fewer OLED panels from Samsung. And Samsung was also unable to secure OLED panel orders from some other pretty big Chinese vendors, smartphone vendors, like Oppo, Vivo, and Xiaomi. So, you know, it's not all about Apple and how many OLED panels Apple is ordering. So there you go. Anyway, that is kind of the latest on the whole Nikkei iPhone cuts sort of news. Let me say right up front that I think that there is going to be an update of Apple's very popular iPhone SE line soon. I think it's going to happen, but a new report this week out of China seems to be a bit too far-fetched for me. They start off pretty good. This comes from the site QQ. They say that Apple is planning an updated model of the iPhone SE with an A10 processor, 2 gigabytes of RAM, and coming in configuration options of 32 gigabytes or 128 gigabytes of storage. Okay, that sounds pretty good right up front. They also say that the model is going to stick with Touch ID and not integrate Face ID. I would agree with that because that's a little bit too pricey for that model to put in the newer Face ID technology and the True Depth camera system. So I buy that, but then things get a little bit weird in the report because they say that Apple is going to switch to a 4.2-inch display. They're going to up the display from the current 4-inch display. And I have to ask, why would they do that? The extra inches are not going to make any kind of difference to the overall experience. And considering the fact that all the reports we've heard so far seem to indicate that the design is not going to change in terms of the physical design of the device. It's still going to have the metal back. It's not going to have the wireless charging. Going to a 4.2-inch display is only going to create more work for developers. It's going to create a new display resolution. It's going to fragment things even further in terms of the operating system. So I don't buy that Apple is upping the size of the display. I guess if they keep the resolution the same, but then again, at what point, what is the advantage of just making it larger, especially considering the fact that one of the big points of popularity for the iPhone SE is the 4-inch form factor, the current size. So you wouldn't want it to get any bigger. So going to a larger display would assume that you're also getting rid of the bezels, but then you've got to cram in the home button still. It just starts to fall apart when you think about that. They also claim that Apple would launch the iPhone SE in June at the Worldwide Developer Conference, which is a conference for developers who tend to be pro users and probably are not iPhone SE buyers. iPhone SE is very much a consumer version of the iPhone. So again, that doesn't make any sense either. And it also doesn't generally fit with the timing of when Apple announces and launches the iPhone SE. The original iPhone SE was announced and launched in March of 2016. And so I would expect any update to also be announced or come out around the March timeframe. So definitely there will be newer specs, but again, I don't expect any kind of form factor change. And while I agree it would be nice if Apple added wireless charging just for consistency across the board, I don't think they're going to do that because that would presume they're going to have to move to a glass back. And I just doubt that that's going to happen on a model that's going to be at that price point. That entry-level model, I think, is going to stay the same and just get a nice little spec bump coming up. It's going to stay in the lineup, again, because it's a very popular model of phone. I know many of you really like the iPhone SE, and it's going to be nice to see an update. But expect that to be coming probably around the end of March. Again, I'm thinking now that March 25th date. I'm going to have to go look and see what day that is, day of the week. But that's probably when we could expect to see that announcement. Another product we could expect to see in a spring update is a new iPad. A French website noted this week that Apple had registered new tablets with the Eurasian Economic Commission. And the reason that they have to do that is they're legally required to register any devices with encryption that will be sold in Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Russia. And so those filings went into place, and the two products that were registered, the numbers for those did not correspond with any existing models of the iPad. Now, we've had rumors for a while of an updated 9.7-inch version of the iPad, the entry-level iPad coming. Basically, the idea is, once again, the specs would be updated with new processors, and that would seem to make sense. But it doesn't account for the fact that there were two models listed in this listing. So then you might presume, well, maybe we get an update to the iPad mini, which is way overdue for a refresh. I know, again, there's a lot of iPad mini fans out there in terms of the form factor. But I hesitate because I'm still of the mind that I don't think the iPad mini is getting any more updates. I think the 4 is kind of the last version, especially with Apple going with new larger form factors, larger and larger form factors of the iPhone. You know, we're expecting that 6.5-inch iPhone 10 Plus this year. And that's getting into that realm and range of the iPad. I know an iPad and an iPhone are not the same thing, but it does start to kind of muddy up the form factor sizes when you get into that realm. So I'm not thinking that there's going to be an iPad mini, but that skew or that reference does give a little bit of hope. You know, maybe Apple is planning on keeping the iPad around, because the only other thing I could think of that could be an iPad update would be an iPad Pro update, and it's really a little bit too early for iPad Pro updates. Those should happen around the June timeframe, if at all, around Worldwide Developer Conference. That's when Apple announced the 10.5-inch and the 12.9-inch iPad Pro last year. So I would expect the updates there. We are expecting iPad Pro updates, and the rumor there has been that Apple would go to a home buttonless bezel, smaller bezel design like the iPhone 10, and bring in Face ID to the iPad Pro lineup. And I fully think that they are going to want to bring the true depth camera system to the iPad, bring in other new features in the camera system to support ARKit and those sorts of things. So I expect those to come, but I would not expect to see those until around the June timeframe. So we are expected to maybe see a 9.7-inch iPad update and maybe an iPad mini update this spring. Again, I'm guessing around the March timeframe, some sort of March event. Bloomberg is also reporting that AirPods are also in the works and that they may see an update. They say, quote, later this year. The idea here is Apple would develop a new wireless chip to put in them that would bring Hey Siri activation. So you'll be able to do that without having to do the awkward tap gesture anymore. It also would open up a second tap gesture for your AirPods. So that would be a nice little update to see. And I think it sounds like a natural next progression for AirPods. They also claim that the future version would include water resistance, so it would be able to survive splashes of water and rain. What I find interesting about that is I've had reports from MacCast listeners who have had their current generation AirPods go through the wash, fall in sinks, and even one listener who had it fall in a snowbank and didn't find the AirPod until next spring. I might have even shared that story on a past episode of the MacCast. I don't remember if I did that or not. But basically, it lived in a snowbank, melted, and in the spring, he went out, found it, picked it up, dried it off, and it worked perfectly fine. So I think there's already, Apple doesn't claim any water resistance in the current generation AirPods. So I guess the change would be they would publicly maybe give it an IPX rating and say it's water resistant, but the current ones seem pretty robust. Again, I wouldn't go around swimming with them on. I wouldn't deliberately get them wet. But I found that interesting in this report because, again, I had some, anecdotal evidence that AirPods can survive at least a small splashing or dunking in some water. And KGI securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo also backed up the Bloomberg report about new AirPods coming, and they also added that Apple is maybe planning to bring out its own brand, not a Beats brand, but its own brand of, quote, high-end over-the-ear headphones with an all-new design. They say the new headphones are expected to come out in the fourth quarter of this year at the earliest, and I guess that means we may not see them this year at all. It's interesting to think that Apple would do its own branded headphones when it has the whole Beats line. It'll be interesting if they do go that route to see what the differentiation is between Apple over the ear headphones and Beats, but I guess we're going to have to wait maybe till the end of the year on that. And then finally, in product updates, Maka Takara thinks that Apple's Air Power Mat will be arriving this March. There are not a lot of details here, but Mac Rumors thinks that the price point for the Air Power Mat is going to be around $199. And for those of you who may have forgotten, the Air Power Mat is Apple's wireless charging mat that they announced back in the fall that will be able to charge three devices at the same time. So you'll be able to put your iPhone 8, 8 Plus, or iPhone 10 on there. And Apple Watch 3, and only the Apple Watch 3 supports it, and possibly your AirPods if you're willing to plunk down the $69 to buy an upgraded wireless charging case for your current AirPods that work with the Air Power Mat. So I'm thinking $199 plus another $69 for your AirPods case. That's a little bit steep, even for Apple products on accessories. I was hoping that the Air Power Mat would come in more around $99, which I think is a little bit of a better price point, or maybe even $129, $149. $200 is a little bit wild, especially considering that you can get Qi wireless charging pads for, around $20 to $30 pretty easily. I have a feeling some smart accessory maker is going to come up with a way to put some cheap kind of chargers into a single kind of case and just run it into a built-in like USB 3-port power hub and have one cable coming off of it, and you have essentially the same thing for a lot cheaper price. I love Apple and I love their accessories, but sometimes it gets a little bit crazy. I know some people will love to have this, and so it's going to sell okay. I just don't think it's going to be the breakthrough accessory of the year, though I know many people are waiting for it, and it looks like maybe March is when it will arrive. Again, lining up for this idea that we might have this kind of March event to announce a bunch of new Apple products. But that's kind of the latest on what we think might be coming from Apple this spring. Fast Company has awarded Apple the honor of being named the most innovative company by them in 2017. And they say it's due to all of the great hardware and software products Apple has released over the past year. Things like the AirPods, software like ARKit, Apple Watch Series 3, and yes, even the iPhone 10. They note that, you know, a lot of people weren't expecting a lot from the iPhone 10, but with Face ID and some of the other technologies and chips that are built in there, it's a pretty amazing device. And it was a nice bump up in the list from Apple's fourth place rank that they were given last year. Fast Company also cited the fact that Apple has done a lot of work in areas like chip development, in cameras and imaging technology, and also in artificial intelligence, giving them a huge advantage as a company and really pushing them, you know, forward in terms of being named most innovative. And I have to say, in a year where it seems like many in the media have been really just on an Apple bashing campaign, it's kind of nice to be reminded really about how much innovation Apple has really brought to the, you know, to the forefront recently. I mean, they're always bringing innovation, but really a lot of the technologies they have developed over the past year have been truly innovative and are really driving a lot of competition. You know, a lot of people like to say in some areas that Apple is following, but in many, many ways, they're still leading, and it's nice to have a good reminder of that. And a great example that was pointed out in the Fast Company piece was Apple's dedication to privacy and how that integrates into the innovation of their hardware and their underlying technologies. You know, to do everything that they do privacy-wise on device, something that a lot of other companies are resorting to the cloud to do in terms of artificial intelligence, you know, that takes a lot of innovation. It takes a lot of technology, and Apple had to develop their own hardware and software solutions, things like the secure enclave that's built into your phone, the Bionic chip that is done used for the facial recognition in the iPhone 10. And not only that, they have to build technology into their processors, into the A series chips, to do all of that, to allow the AR process or the AI processing to happen on device. That takes a lot of computing power. It's not easy to do. And so Apple really has to build up that technology and innovate in those areas. And that takes time and dedication and development. They also point to technology like the W1 chip that drives Apple's AirPods. And it's really what makes them the best Bluetooth wireless headphones out there, because they're not just relying on the Bluetooth technology, which historically has been, let's admit it, a little bit flaky. Your Bluetooth devices, they will drop their connections. They don't always work. I can honestly say my AirPods, I have very few issues with them. And I don't know if I've ever, I'm trying to think of if I ever experienced a dropout beyond having dropouts when the batteries are running down and I didn't bother to plug them back in. And the range and the reliability, they're really just unparalleled. And that doesn't happen. While it feels magical, it doesn't happen by accident. It's not some magical, mystical thing. It's the innovation and the time and the care spent on the technology that really makes that happen. And in sort of a companion interview with Tim Cook, Fast Company asked him about a lot of these things. And he reiterated that, you know, for Apple, it's really the products that drive the company and not the money or the stock price. He says, quote, "Stock price is a result, not an achievement by itself. For me, it's about products and people. Did we make the best product, and did we enrich people's lives?" And I really believe, you know, despite what some in the media want to say and some of the things that have been going on over the past year, that Apple is a company that is truly focused on trying to build and create the best products for their customers. They really believe in that product experience. They really let that drive them. They do not let the stock market or shareholders drive their product innovation. They also don't, and I think this is important to point out, they don't let their competitors drive or influence their product decisions. And that works really great sometimes, and occasionally doesn't work out so well. And that's when we hear some of the, you know, some of the negatives. But overall, I have to say it's generally positive, a positive direction for the company. And it's why I buy and continue to use and love Apple products. It's that integration of the experience. And I know this past year has been a little rough in some areas. We've had some little flubs and issues. But if you step back from the minor annoyances that we've gone through, the few bugs, you know, some of them more serious than others, but none of them really that catastrophic in the grand scheme of things. There's a lot of annoyances. One of the ones is the MacBook Pro keyboard bug, I think, was pretty awful. Some of the little security bugs were kind of egg on Apple's faces, but did they really have a large impact in terms of the consumer experience? I would generally say no. I have to say that macOS High Sierra, that transition has seemed to gone pretty well for most people I know. I still haven't upgraded just because I haven't had time, but I'm looking forward to that upgrade, and I'm not expecting any big issues. And then there's great products like the AirPods and the HomePod, and you know, really even some of the products that have taken a bashing, like the Touch Bar MacBook Pro. When I talk to owners who have had them for a while, they generally like them a lot. And you know, so I think that's a testament to say that, you know, Apple is definitely very much still product and consumer focused, you know, on that side of things. That definitely is what drives Apple in that area. I want to point out, though, that I don't believe that they do that in a vacuum. I don't think that Apple completely ignores the shareholders or the stock price, especially when it comes to some of their choices they make around how they run their business, how they price their products, how they sell things, how they market things. That's a little bit different, but that's not what Tim Cook is talking about here. You know, there are business choices that they make that are purely, in my opinion, about benefiting the stockholders and the stock price, and that don't put the consumer first. But I think that's the responsible thing for any publicly held company to do. And the example this year that I could really give of that is the choice of how to price the iPhone X. I really think that was more about pushing up the average selling price of the iPhone as iPhone sales are sort of slowing down or leveling off, plateauing, and that is definitely happening. There's a lot of evidence to that. It's become a mature product. If you think about a product, say, like the iPod, you have many, many years of really good growth, and then you get to a point where it's a mature product, and it's going to have some stasis for a long time before it begins to slowly decline and drop off. These things don't drop off a cliff, but we're going to have, you watch, we're going to have iPhone sales years where the number of iPhones sold are going to remain about the same with very small declines over the next 3 years or so. And then as whatever technology we get that's going to replace our smartphones comes along and matures, then you'll start to see this slow decline. And that's the period we're in. So to get through that, Apple made the business choice and decision to try and push the average selling price of at least the premium end of the line up to kind of prop up the numbers and profits as they go through that transition. And so that's definitely about making a decision to the benefit of Apple's bottom line and the shareholders and the stock price, and certainly not for, you know, making iPhones more affordable for the customers. There's not a direct customer benefit, and customers' lives are not enriched by having to pay more for an iPhone. I don't think anybody could argue that. Now, is it bad that Apple did that? No, I don't think it is. You know, there's a lot of people that are happy to pay a premium for a premium product, and it keeps the health of the company very good, and I think it was the smart business decision thing to do. But again, when it comes to products, Apple, I fully believe, is dedicated and fully focused on that customer experience. I have no doubt about that at any point. Tim Cook also does point out that Apple doesn't follow, even when people think that they do or presume that they do. The example, the interviewer kind of asked him about the HomePod and said, hey, you know, you're innovating with things like Face ID on the iPhone X, but you're kind of following in the footsteps of, you know, Amazon and Google when it comes to smart speaker products. And Tim had to point out that, you know, that's really not the case. The HomePod has been in development for a very long time, long before there were other smartphone speakers. A lot of the rumors we've heard that say that the HomePod has been in development for like 6 years. Even if it hasn't been that long, it's been in development for a long time. And, you know, that's probably why the HomePod is not a direct competitor to, say, the Echo. I don't even put them in the same class. And I think the history of the HomePod development shows that. And also, again, sort of proves Tim Cook's point that Apple doesn't really look at what their competitors are doing. They pick a product, they decide what direction they want to move in, and then they try and build the absolute best product they can for their customers that meets what they were trying to, that meets the requirements for what they were trying to design it for. And with the HomePod, it was about creating a great music experience, and not necessarily a smart speaker experience. Although, again, I think there was some dedication to what kinds of smart speaker experiences they were going to have on the HomePod. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But, you know, he pointed out Apple waits until a product is great in their minds before shipping it. So they start developing something and they keep working on it, they keep perfecting it until they achieve what they want, that there's not this sort of set schedule of when they were going to release it. And he even pointed out that things they are working on now are planned for release 3 to 4 years out. So they can't be following anybody if the products they are thinking about are products that are going to be released 3 years from now. Now, are they influenced when a competitor comes out with something in the meantime that is similar or in the same vein? I have to imagine that they might be. Again, with the HomePod, the story that we've heard is Amazon came out with the Echo and Apple decided to build in some of these smart features. It was originally all about being an audio speaker, and then they started adding in these things. And I think that's only, again, so that it is relevant to consumers, you know, because technology changes so fast. You can't plan for everything when you're looking 3 to 4 years out. You have to be able to pivot and adapt a little bit. So I think they are adapting their products. Consequently, I think that's caused a lot of people to look at the HomePod and classify it as a smart speaker, but I think that's the wrong classification for it. And, you know, Apple doesn't worry about that stuff too much. I've mentioned this in the show before. So it was interesting to hear and see Tim Cook talking about that in this Fast Company interview. And in case you missed it, you should check it out. It is a great read. So check it out. It's on the Fast Company website right now. In a different kind of innovation, there's a report from Bloomberg that Apple has been in talks with cobalt mining companies for over a year now, that they've been going back and forth. And you might be asking, well, why would Apple be talking to cobalt miners? That's because cobalt is a key component in the making of lithium ion batteries. And I think there's no argument that Apple needs a lot of lithium ion batteries. And there are two problems, though, with cobalt. And one of them is that the supply can be volatile and can fluctuate. Changes can severely impact Apple's ability to deliver products. It also can severely impact the prices that Apple has to pay for batteries. So, you know, they want to sort of level that out, and they want to have good access to those supplies when they're building new products. The other thing is that historically, cobalt suppliers are not always the most scrupulous when it comes to how they do business. Specifically, they've had issues with things like child labor. Apple being very far removed from the supply chain, you know, they've gotten in a little bit of trouble in the past when it's sort of been traced back that, you know, they buy batteries from some supplier, the supplier gets their components for making batteries from someone else, and that person is actually dealing with the mining company. So they're like, you know, 2-3 degrees removed from these companies, yet they still get blamed when it comes out that, hey, one of these suppliers was illegally using child labor. It's a pretty awful thing to have to deal with. So by going directly to the mining companies, Apple can do a couple things. One, they can help guarantee that they have a good supply. They can also have much better control of who they are working with and what kinds of business practices and things that they are doing. They would have more control on that, more leverage over that sort of thing. They would also be in better control of pricing. You know, they can set a price for a long-term contract and not have to worry about the volatility of the market or what's going on with their competitors or other suppliers trying to get those batteries. So Apple is supposedly looking for a long-term deal, something in the time frame of 5 years or more, and that would be ultimately a very good thing, because as Apple knows and as we probably know, Apple is going to only need more lithium ion batteries in the future, not less. So, you know, Apple's not just innovative on the product side, they also have to be very innovative on the business side. And we've seen many examples of this, from their getting into, you know, chip and processor design all the way through now to you know, going directly to source components for a lot of their products at the, you know, very basic level. This is going all the way down to getting the raw mineral materials for something that goes into part of their products. So that's kind of pretty interesting and amazing. Looks like Apple Pay Cash might be hitting Europe and Brazil. Friday, we started seeing scattered reports, unconfirmed reports at this point. I've got some feelers out to find out, and maybe some of you can confirm this for us, that Apple Pay Cash has been being rolled out in various countries. Tim Cook had said that they would be bringing Apple Pay Cash to additional countries later this year, but he had not really given any hard dates. Nine to Five Mac reported that they were getting word from users in the UK, Ireland, Spain, and also Brazil that they were seeing access to Apple Pay Cash in the messaging app. It's not clear which banks and cards and things are being supported at this point. It's also not clear if you'll be able to send money internationally with Apple Pay Cash. There's typically some sort of fee if you're using a credit card. If you use a bank or debit card, there generally isn't a fee when you're using Apple Pay Cash. But with exchange rates and things like that, who knows how it's going to work, if at all, internationally. So I'd be interested to know, one, if any of you in other countries outside the US are seeing access to Apple Pay Cash and where you are. And secondarily, if you've tried sending money internationally, are you able to do it, one? And two, how big of, if any, fee are you getting charged for transferring Apple Pay Cash internationally? But regardless, it looks like Apple Pay Cash is rolling out to the wider world at large. And now getting into some of the smart speaker stuff I was alluding to earlier, there was a survey of 520 U.S. customers about smart speakers, and this was done by Loop Ventures recently, and it seems to confirm what Apple has already stated in regards to the features they chose to give Siri in the HomePod at launch. Apple claimed that they looked at how most people used smart speakers and they tried to focus on those features first inside HomePod. The Loop Ventures survey found that of the 520 people surveyed, just 31% owned a smart speaker. So keep in mind, this is a pretty small sample size. You can't really draw too much from it, but I still found it interesting. So of the 161 people who owned a smart speaker, Amazon definitely dominated with the Echo. 55% share went to Amazon. 23% of the owners had a Google Home. 15% had some sort of Microsoft Cortana device. And 3% actually had HomePods, which is pretty good considering that the survey just happened and the HomePod has only been out for a few weeks. Now, if you do the math, though, that means five people in this survey responding actually had a HomePod. Hey, well, at least we're represented, right? And the more interesting part of the survey was how people were actually using their smart speakers. The largest percentage, 38%, were using it for music. Okay, so HomePod, check. It does music incredibly well. So it's hitting the largest percentage of smart home speaker use. The second most used feature by 33%, weather. HomePod can do weather, no problem. The next one, HomePod is kind of okay with. 31% said they used it for general questions. I've been asking several general questions to my HomePod, and I would say, you know, 60, 70% of the time it understands what I'm asking for. The other 30%, it's not so good. I think Apple could do a little bit better with just general questions. Sports and news, calling, texting, and emailing, and smart home control were the next kind of three most used features on a smart speaker, and those were all around 10% usage each. Sports and news, the HomePod can do incredibly well. Texting, you can get your messages read back to you. Email, I don't know about. I actually haven't tried email on there. And calling, you have to start the call on your iPhone and then send it over to the HomePod. You can't accept a phone call or make a phone call on the HomePod. So I think Apple has some work to do there. But smart home control, hey, if you're using HomeKit, it works beautifully. So, you know, I would say Apple has done with HomePod exactly what they said they did which was focus on the most used smart home features and try to make those really good and work pretty well. And I think a lot of these other things will be coming in the future. But, you know, a lot of people are getting smart speakers, and really what they're using them mostly for is music and weather. So there you have it. All right, with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you about PDF Pen right now. You know, I am a huge fan. If you've heard the MacCast, you know I am a PDF Pen user. It is really the ultimate tool you could have for editing and working with PDFs. If you're going paperless, if you're doing any kind of paperless workflow, I really think you will benefit greatly from owning a copy of PDF Pen or PDF Pen Pro. Right now, this time of year is one of the times when I heavily rely on PDF Pen because I'm getting ready for taxes. I'm having to assemble all my documentation. I'm having to fill out forms and things. I'm having to sign things and send them back to my accountant. And I don't know how I would do it without PDF Pen. It's great for organizing your documents at the end of the year. You can split and combine PDFs. So you send just the things that your accountant or person needs. You're not sending, you know, these massive documents that, you know, he only needs three pages, he or she only needs three pages out of. You can use it, like I said, to fill in all those PDF forms, whether or not they were created as PDF forms. And that's a big deal. I get a lot of forms that are what I call fake forms, right? They have the lines and they have the spaces you're supposed to fill out, but they're not actually clickable. So you can add all that stuff, and you can even do it automatically with PDF Pen. It'll analyze the document, find those spaces, and put in the form fields for you. It's amazing. You can add page numbers. You can block out and redact account numbers. And what's really important is it doesn't just put a box over the image. It actually wipes out the underlying metadata if it's been OCR'd or something like that. So that information isn't going to leak through. It can perform OCR on scanned documents. You can find and highlight things. So if you need to point something out, you can put in annotations. All of that stuff built into PDF Pen. And if you want to step up to PDF Pen Pro, you can do great things like create PDF portfolios, meaning you can put collections of multiple PDFs or related files together. And that's great for presenting your end of year documents. So you don't have to take my word for it. You can head to smilesoftware.com/podcast, and you can learn more about PDF Pen. You can check out all their great features. And another thing that Smile does a great job of is giving you examples and showing you and helping you with how to get better use out of their software like PDF Pen. They have a great blog with great tutorials and tips and information. So definitely head to smilesoftware.com/podcast. Check out PDF Pen and all the other great apps that Smile makes. And a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. Let's get into Apple's battery replacement program. I know we've been talking a lot about your experiences getting your batteries replaced. A lot of people want to get their batteries replaced, and some people, unfortunately, have run into a few issues going into the Apple retail store and having to wait or having to come back later to get the battery replaced, and that's not an experience that you want to have. So as I thought in the last MacCast, I figured we probably have some insiders, maybe some people who work as Apple geniuses or in Apple service centers, and I thought maybe some of them could give us a little bit of insider information, share the scoop on how best to go about reserving and getting a battery replaced at the retail store. And I have to say, I wasn't disappointed by our community. We're going to keep everybody's information anonymous. So from anonymous sources, we have heard that one of the reasons why we've been getting these mixed reports from you about your experiences in replacing batteries is that it seems that only recently has AppleCare support been authorized or given the ability to actually be able to reserve a replacement battery. I was told that this part of the program started about mid-January, so if you tried to get a battery replacement before that, you might have had a little worse experience. But as it stands now, you should be able to use either the AppleCare or the Apple Support app on your phone or AppleCare phone support or chat to actually be able to reserve a replacement battery for an iPhone 6 or later. So you can go to getsupport.apple.com, use the website, or open up the Apple Support app on your phone, and then make sure you go in and set up an AppleCare phone call. So have them call you back. And that, if you've never used that service before, let me just put a quick plug for that. It is amazing. You can go into the support app, say what your issue is, in this case that you want to get a replacement battery, and you can schedule a time when you know you're going to be around and by your phone for an AppleCare support rep to call you back. And they call you right at that time. They get you on the phone and you can get your support right away. I'm also a big fan of using chat support. I think that's great. So you can use the chat support app, and you can set everything up. Tell them you want to reserve a replacement battery. You need to be very clear, so there's no confusion about what you're asking for. Tell them that you want to replace your battery. You want to get a reservation. You want to make sure that the battery is going to be there and at the Apple retail store when you go in for a replacement. And they can set all of that up for you. That should be something that they can do now. You'll notice when you go into the support site or the support app and you go into the battery replacement section, it'll even say there that you can use chat support or phone support to reserve a battery. So just make sure you're going through the right process and you're saying the right things so you get what you want. I was also told that if you're using an Apple authorized service provider, the experience might be a little bit different and probably not as ideal. Unfortunately, Apple authorized service providers are required by Apple to actually see your device and run a diagnostic on it before they're able to actually order parts. And this is on all devices and Mac products that they need to repair or fix, not just iPhones. And as far as I've been told, there's not an exception now with Apple authorized service providers for the battery stuff. So if you only have the option of going to an AASP, you're probably going to have to take your phone in there, have them look at it. They're probably going to order the battery for you, and then you're going to have to come back and get the replacement. It just doesn't seem like there's any way around that right now. Hopefully Apple will go back on or change that policy specifically related to batteries, at least this year, because of how they're doing that. And another thing somewhat related to this that we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast was water damage on Apple products. I think we had one MacCast listener, unfortunately, that had gone in for a battery replacement and they found that the liquid contact indicators, the LCI stickers that were in the iPhone, had been tripped and they refused to replace the battery on the phone because they said that the phone itself was damaged and the phone that needed to be replaced because of the water damage. They didn't want to put a new battery in a damaged phone. I think, you know, you can reasonably understand that, but from the customer's perspective, there was nothing wrong with the phone. The phone was working and operating perfectly fine except for the battery. But it's just standard Apple policy that if the liquid contact indicators are tripped, that they won't service the phone. And I mentioned that on many of the phones, and I pointed you to an Apple support article that showed where the LCIs, the liquid contact indicators, were. And on many of the phones, they were in the SIM slot. So you could pop out the SIM card and you could look in there with a flashlight and see if you saw a red dot or a red indicator. And that would indicate that the LCI in your iPhone had been tripped and that it detected some sort of water damage. Well, I heard again from an Apple authorized service provider that there's not just one sticker in your devices. There's actually multiples and they're in multiple places and there's different kinds of stickers. And even on things like MacBook Pros, some of those stickers, those indicators need to be viewed under an ultraviolet light to be able to tell if they've been tripped. So that's not necessarily the only place that Apple will look to see if your LCI has been tripped. And also, they pointed out that even if the liquid indicator in the SIM slot has been tripped, it doesn't necessarily place the unit out of warranty or affect the repair facility's ability to actually repair the unit. If they open it up and as long as there's no other signs of water damage like rust or corrosion, or if the internal sensors have not been tripped, then you might still be able to get service without issue. The tripping of the internal indicators, though, are a little bit more severe. So if they open that up and they see an internal indicator has tripped, or they see other signs of liquid or water damage, things like rust or corrosion, or, you know, residual, a lot of times there will be, calcium deposits or other things from water or liquid evaporating out of there. If they see any of that sort of thing, then that's a red flag that there has been water intrusion and they might not be able to service your unit without, you know, doing a full replacement. So at least in the case of the Apple authorized service providers, I was told that, you know, if those internal indicators are tripped, they are required by Apple to deny any component repairs and only offer you a whole unit replacement as at cost. So I'm sharing a lot of this information with you so that maybe, especially if you're going into an Apple authorized service provider, you can be a little bit more sympathetic with like the rules that are placed on them by Apple, right? They have certain rules they have to follow. They can't really deviate from those. And as frustrating as it can be for us customers sometimes when we just want to get service on our device, knowing that I think helps you understand and maybe deal with what's going on a little bit better. So thanks to everybody who wrote in and shared the information with us. It's great for us to be able to have this and share it with the community. And I certainly appreciate your efforts in that regard. I want to follow up on something that I talked about last episode with regard to Apple Music and specifically the metadata related to albums. You know, I was giving some criticism based on an article that I read that I really agreed with, that, you know, Apple has some work to do when it comes to how they categorize music and specifically albums. The issue being that, you know, if you search for an artist in Apple Music and then you click on all albums, once you do that search result, you will get everything that that artist has ever been involved with in terms of an album. That means compilations, that means soundtracks. So if they just had one track on the soundtrack of, you know, some album, that will come up. And the problem with that is that when you start using something like HomePod or AirPods and you're relying on voice to be able to recall and get your music, it's a little bit challenging to get the exact right music you want. Because if you don't remember the exact name of the album or something like that, you could end up getting something completely different than what you were thinking. And Bruce wrote in to point out a really great trick, which is that, you know, if you search for Apple Music just by artist name, or search in Apple Music on artist name, what happens is you get this search result and it comes up with, I think, the artist, possible artist name, and there's a link to go to the artist page. And then there is an albums section with a link, and this is the one that I was talking about that you click, that says all albums, and then I think it has songs after that, and it goes on and on. What he pointed out to me was that if in that first search result you click on all albums, you get the result that I explained, which is compilations, soundtracks, just about everything that artist has ever been involved with in terms of an album. But Bruce said, you know, if you actually, on that first search result page, instead of clicking on the all albums link, if you click on the artist's name or the artist link, the artist option, and go to their profile page, the main Apple Music profile page for that artist, there is another albums section in there. And in that albums section, you're really going to only get the albums that are from that artist. So you won't get things like compilations and soundtracks. And so I tested this out, and this is absolutely true. It does work this way, but it actually still helps illustrate the deeper metadata problem that I was discussing in the last show. Because when you click on all albums from the artist's page, you still get things like the album singles, the special releases, the remixed versions, the deluxe albums. So it's not just those main, I don't know what you call them, like studio release albums. It's not just those albums. It's every kind of thing as an album. So the problem is that Apple classifies an album or every kind of album as an album. And really, I think most of us, when we think about an album, we think of that thing that is, you know, 13 tracks or 15 tracks that an artist puts out every couple years, and that's the album. We're not talking about the single that has four versions of the same track, or the special release, or that remixed thing that they did in between album releases. And that just kind of muddies up the whole search results. And so I think it's kind of a confusing and antiquated way of looking at the music data. Another thing I found very confusing about the whole albums thing is a lot of times the artwork that is used for the album is exactly the same. So it's visually hard to distinguish what's the actual album and what's the single thing, other than looking at maybe the song name that shows up as the album, quote unquote, album name for the single version of the album. And I think it would just be easy enough to add subtypes of albums so that in addition to kind of the main releases, you have singles and deluxe versions and remixes. And I think Spotify actually handles it this way, and it does it a little bit better. They, you know, there's kind of these own, there's this special subtype of album that fits under the main album releases. I don't know, maybe I'm crazy on this. And Bruce, I thank you for writing in and kind of sharing your opinion, because Bruce doesn't agree with me. He likes it the other way. He says, I like the fact that when I go into an artist, I can see their whole history, their whole chronology of albums. I can see that they released the album's single, you know, the same year, but before the actual album, however it might be. So he likes that a little bit better. But, you know, maybe I'm going about this the wrong way. Maybe the way I'm thinking about it is wrong. And I'd love to hear from some of you, because the ultimate goal is I just wish things worked a little bit better in Apple Music. I'm not one of these people that I love Apple Music. I think it's great. Most of the time I can find what I want, but there's quirky things that happen. And I think a lot of it has to do with the categorization and how the metadata is set up. I don't even think it's the artificial intelligence that Apple has built. I think the problem is the data going into the artificial intelligence is confusing, and the artificial intelligence gets confused when you're asking for certain things. And I think it goes back to the old days of iTunes. You know, I think it's the classic problem about iTunes was built in an age that was just different than the age we're in now with regards to how music is served up and how we consume and manage and work with music. And I think Apple needs to do a little work on the underlying data structure to kind of fix things. And I don't know that they're actually doing that or if they will be working on that, but it's something that I hope they do work on. So again, I'd love to hear your thoughts and opinions on this. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com, and certainly an audio comment is very welcomed. So if you want to record a little 2 or 3 minute opinion on this, send that along, and we'll be happy to share it on a future episode of the MacCast. Now, we talked about some software updates coming out this week, and one of those updates was Mac OS 10.13.3, the supplemental update. Here's an odd and I think annoying issue that listener Jeff has brought to my attention, and there's no way I would have known about this because it specifically impacts iMac Pro owners, but what he found out was that when the 10.13.3 update came out, he was able to quickly and easily apply that to his old standard iMac. But when he tried to do the same update from software update on his iMac Pro, he kept getting a 700 error and was confused by that, didn't really know what a 700 error was. Just what he knew was that the update would not install on his iMac Pro. So he did a little Googling, as we all do, and discovered that for the iMac Pro, there was actually a completely separate update that you needed to download manually from Apple's support website and run. And once he did that, it ran fine. He updated his iMac Pro, and away he went. Well, again, the 10.13.3 supplemental update comes out, and Jeff was told by software update on his iMac Pro, the software updater, hey, there's an update here and available. Would you like to install it? And of course, he says, yes, absolutely, I want to install that. Clicks, goes to install it, walks away to do some things, comes back about 28 minutes later, and the whole update is stalled out. It's not doing anything, and he's like, what's going on? And yep, you guessed it. You know what the problem was? There was a completely separate install for the Mac OS 10.13.3 supplemental update for the iMac Pro. And yes, you had to manually go to Apple's support website and download it. So what the heck is going on here? I mean, come on. They are using the software update utility built into Mac OS on the iPad Pro to notify you that there is an update available, but they're not smart enough at this point to be able to know and deliver the correct software update for their brand new $5,000 iMac Pro. Yeah. And you might be wondering, well, did Jeff start from a fresh install of macOS, or did he clone macOS from a clone backup to his new iMac Pro? Because I thought, well, maybe what's going on here is you brought the old operating system over and it still thinks it's on that old iMac. You know, maybe there's some key or something going. Nope, that wasn't the case. Jeff said he wanted a clean new version of his iMac Pro, started from a brand new, complete, clean install of macOS on the iMac Pro. So don't email me if you think that's what's going on, because that is not what's happening. This seems like another one of the little missed things from Apple, where something that should just work is not working. And I don't know why this happened, and I don't know why they haven't fixed it yet, because it's amazing to me that it was a problem with the 10.13.3 update, and then again with the supplemental update. The only thing I can think of, Jeff, is that maybe with the supplemental update, they just didn't think about it. You know, like it's an incremental update. So since 10.13.3 didn't work the way you would expect it, they hadn't tweaked the supplemental update to work the way you would expect it. I would fully hope, and I'd love to hear back from you when 10.13.4 comes out. If this happens again, I think Apple's got a real problem on their hands and something they need to fix in their quality assurance. But Jeff shared that information with us, and I know there's maybe only a handful of you out there with an iMac Pro, but in case you run into this, I figured it was good information to share so that you don't get frustrated like Jeff does. Just know when the update comes out, you might want to check Apple's support website first and see if there's a separate version for your iMac Pro. Here's another little bug, a little thing to warn you about if you're running macOS High Sierra and if you're wanting to more and more use Apple's new Apple File System, APFS. Developer and creator of Carbon Copy Cloner, Mike Bombick, discovered an issue with APS Apple File System formatted sparse disk images that could, if you're not careful, result in data loss, which is something that none of us want. And specifically, you know, sparse disk images are often used by many of us for backup purposes or within backup applications. As a matter of fact, that's one reason why Mike Bombick is playing around with these things, is because he makes Carbon Copy Cloner, which is a great backup software. So for those of you who may or may not know, a sparse bundle is a file, basically a file on macOS that you can create with disk utility or through other methods that mounts on your desktop and is treated as if it were a physically attached classic hard drive with a disk structure and a volume structure and stuff like that. And with sparse bundles, so you think of a classic disk image, it works like that. So they are a disk image, but a sparse bundle is kind of a special version of that, where you define a total size that you want that image to be able to grow to. So you might say, hey, I need a 1 terabyte sparse image bundle. But then what happens is that bundle only uses as much storage as the stuff that you put on it. Again, very much like a hard drive. So if you put 500 gigabytes on that, that is only going to use up 500 gigabytes of total space. Now, if you need to add more stuff later, it will continue to grow until it reaches that 1 terabyte size. But the idea is they'll be able to grow and shrink as you change the storage and data that you put on them. And so what he found was that while he was testing these APFS sparse bundles, he had one that was reporting, the bundle was saying, okay, I've got tons of space available. You know, I've got 500, let's just make up some numbers. These aren't from Mike's thing, but let's just make some up. So I've got 500 gigabytes available in the disk image. Yet that file, that sparse bundle file, was sitting on a hard drive that was completely full. So in reality, it didn't have any extra or actually very little storage space. So what Mike tried to do was he said, okay, let's see what happens since the disk image thinks there's a lot of space available. What happens if I try to copy this video file over to that sparse bundle? And to his surprise, what he found was that it copied just fine. No issues whatsoever. And as a matter of fact, he could even play back that video file on that sparse bundle just fine. And I have a feeling the reason why this worked is that works is that APFS has this really cool kind of, I don't know if you call it cloning technology, but it has a technology built into it where it kind of mirrors the bits, but doesn't really kind of copy them. And I think there's some of that going on here. So it would play back just fine. But of course, what happened was after he unmounted that disk image and then remounted it, the video file was completely corrupt. You know, all of the data was not there. All of the data obviously had not been copied over to the sparse bundle because there wasn't a place for that data to go to. So he identified kind of two problems here with this bug. One is that the free space on an APFS formatted sparse disk image doesn't update when the free space on the underlying physical host disk is reduced or probably grows. So, you know, as the drive space on your physical drive is changing, it's not updating those APFS disk images. So the disk image can think it has space available when it really doesn't. And then the other problem, of course, is that when you're actually doing the copying over to the APFS volume, the sparse bundle, there's no errors reported when the bundle discovers, hey, I can't grow any bigger because there's no actual disk space for me to grow to. And the problem there of not reporting an error is that the bits being written to that sparse bundle suddenly go off into some void, some unknown space or area never to be seen from again. And that's when you can have data loss or data corruption going on. So Bombic sourced the issue to two bugs in macOS High Sierra related to the Disk Images Helper service, and he's reported those issues to Apple, so hopefully they'll be fixed in a future update. But for now, you know, I would really advise if you're using macOS High Sierra and you're working with sparse bundles and disk images that you don't format them in APFS format. Don't use the Apple file format, file system format until this actually gets fixed. And what was interesting about this report is that Time Machine makes extensive use of sparse bundles. And I have to wonder a little bit if these bugs are not at least part of the reason why APFS is not supported on Time Machine volumes. Yet, I think Apple's going to bring out that functionality, but for now, you cannot APFS format your Time Machine volumes. You have to go with the older macOS extended HFS Plus format. So, very interesting. And again, general advice, avoid using APFS formatted sparse bundles on your Mac until this gets fixed. All right, last thing that I want to talk to you about in this episode of the MacCast is File Vault 2. I think I've mentioned in the past that I have been using File Vault 2 on my MacBook Pro for a while, but I've never really talked about the reasons why, and we've never really gotten into and answered a number of questions I get when I start talking about File Vault 2. And what prompted all of this is I've been going back and forth a lot with a listener named Rick on email about enabling and using File Vault 2 on the Mac. And he asked a lot of really great, great questions when we were going back and forth, questions that many of you have also asked me, and something that I thought we should bring up and talk about, especially if you're considering using File Vault 2. So I guess the first one is, what is File Vault 2 and why would you want to use it? And File Vault 2 is Apple's whole disk encryption that is built into macOS. And it's been there since macOS Lion and later. And what it does is it encrypts the entire contents of your boot drive, your Mac's hard drive, and anytime you're not logged into your Mac, you're not actively using and logged into your Mac, that volume is totally and completely encrypted. And that means that if your hard drive were to get stolen or ripped out of your Mac or taken someplace, that no one could get at those contents without knowing your login credentials for your Mac. And so it keeps everything secure and safe. It encrypts the entire contents of the hard drive anytime you're not logged in. That is ultimately a good thing for protecting your security and privacy. So if your Mac gets stolen, something like that. So how do you enable File Vault 2? That's maybe the next question. And that is something that is really easy to do. Basically, you open up System Preferences, you go into the Security and Privacy System Preferences, and you click on the File Vault tab. And then you'll need to click the little lock icon in the lower left-hand corner. You'll have to enter an administrator username and password, and then click the Turn on File Vault button. Now, if you have other user accounts on your Mac, you are probably going to get a dialog asking you to enable access for the other users, because any user on the system is going to need to be able to decrypt the drive when they log in. So there you'll see the list of users. You can click Enable User, and in that option you're going to have to enter the password for that user to allow them to gain access to the system once File Vault encryption has been enabled. If you don't, then they'll need to have an account login with File Vault access to be able to access the Mac, because what's going to happen is after they log in or attempt to log in, it's going to need to be able to decrypt that volume, and it can't do that without the File Vault credentials. So you're just going to want to set up each user on the system so that this works. Once you've done that, then you're going to get a series of questions asking you to choose how you want to be able to unlock your disk and reset your password in case you ever forget that password. And there's kind of three options, really two, depending upon which version of the operating system you're using. So if you're using OS X Yosemite or later, you can choose to use your iCloud account to be able to unlock your disk and reset your password. Again, this is if you were ever to forget your login credentials for your Mac. If you're using OS X Mavericks, you can choose to store a File Vault recovery key with Apple by providing a couple of questions and answers, three different security questions. And you're going to need to be able to choose answers that you can remember, because when you call up Apple support and try and get them to unlock your File Vault volume, you're going to need to be able to answer those questions. Now, if you don't want to use any kind of iCloud or Apple keys for File Vault recovery, then it's going to create a local recovery key for you. It's going to actually present that to you, series of numbers and letters. You're going to need to be able to keep that key somewhere safe. So print it out and put it in a vault somewhere, or a safety deposit box. Or what I do is copy it and put it into 1Password. Now, Apple's going to tell you not to store it on your system, you know, the system that has the File Vault disk on it. Yeah, you don't want to do that if it's unencrypted, but use a password manager like 1Password. That is fully encrypted and should be a safe place to keep that. One other thing to note when you're choosing these, if you choose either of the first two options, know that Apple will have the ability to recover your data, get your password information back, and also be able to decrypt your data that's on your File Vault volume. Now, that doesn't mean that Apple will access your data or try to access your data. It just means that they do have access and you're trusting Apple with that information. But by the same token, by Apple having that information, by having it tied to potentially your iCloud account, it means that if your iCloud account gets hacked or somebody tries to socially engineer Apple support, they potentially could get access to your data. It also means that if Apple is subpoenaed by the US government, you know, there's an FBI investigation and they want access to that data, Apple does have the keys if forced to do so to unlock that data. So if you don't like that option, don't choose to have an iCloud recovery option. But no, if you don't choose to have an iCloud recovery option and you forget your password to your machine, there is absolutely nothing Apple is going to be able to do to help you recover your data. So you have to kind of make that choice of security versus privacy at that point. Personally, you know, I just use my iCloud account. I like having the backup. I like not having to worry about it too much, but you're going to have to make that decision on your own. But that's how you enable and turn on File Vault access. So once File Vault is turned on, there's a number of questions I often get asked. One of them, one of the first ones is how does login work once File Vault is turned on? And the way it works is that your Mac actually boots to the login screen, but it's not the login screen that you had before turning on File Vault. It actually boots into and relies on a little bit the macOS recovery volume. Because again, remember, the whole disk is encrypted, so even the operating system can't read that till it is unencrypted. So what it does is it boots to this sort of login screen that hangs off of the recovery volume. And once you log into that, and it's also important to point out that because of this, you can't have auto login turned on. So if you're one of those people that likes booting up your Mac and being automatically logged into your Mac, you cannot do that with File Vault turned on, again, because the disk is encrypted. So you have to go to the login screen. And then once you put in your account credentials and are authenticated, then that will give File Vault access to decrypt the drive, and that then securely passes on your login credentials to the main Mac login. And this all happens in the background, so you only enter your login credentials once, and then it will authenticate it and continue to boot up your Mac as normal. Another thing to note is that enabling File Vault also turns on a special guest account with Safari only access to the Mac. And the reason it does this is that if your device does get stolen or taken or lost or somebody tries to use it, they can log into this guest account. And when they do that, it will connect to the internet. And if you're using Find My Mac, it'll be able to report back that information. So they're put off into the special kind of sandbox area. They won't be able to gain access to any of the other parts of your system. That's all kept secure and protected. Again, I think because the guest account runs through the recovery volume. They're not actually logging into the Mac. They're not decrypting the drive. But it does give them enough access to trigger the ability to connect to an open Wi-Fi network and report back location and data information. Also gives you the opportunity to potentially erase your Mac if you're worried about your data being compromised. So it's actually kind of a good little thing that it turns on. So a question that I often get asked next is, will turning on File Vault 2 affect my performance? And I would say overall, no, you're not going to really notice any day-to-day performance degradation. What you will notice when you first enable it is that there is a little bit of a slowdown because it does have to encrypt the entire drive. And that process can take a little bit of time. It's happening in the background. When I've enabled File Vault, I haven't noticed it at all. But if you have, I guess, really heavy intensive processor needs, you might notice it. And it can take a while, depending upon the size of your drive and how much data you have on there. It can take several days for that to process. And once you've initiated the encryption process, it's not easy to monitor or stop. There are a few ways, but they're a little bit hacky, a little bit too technical to get into now. I would say just turn it on, let it run. Don't worry about it too much. After the initial encryption, you're not going to see really much, if any, impact because the encryption is happening automatically and on the fly in little bits, right? As you add new information, that gets encrypted, and that doesn't take very long or very much processing power, so you should be fine. Another question usually revolves around doing backups. You know, can I still use Time Machine? Can I use Carbon Copy Cloner or Super Duper, my clone backups? What about online backups? Is File Vault 2 going to affect that in any way? And the answer is no. You know, anytime you are booted up and logged into your Mac, your drive is in that unencrypted state. So that means that things like Time Machine, cloned backups, anything that happens automatically, online backups, those are going to run just fine because they're working with the unencrypted drive, the unencrypted data. By that same token, though, it's also important to point out that means that those backups themselves are not encrypted by default. For Time Machine, you can encrypt your Time Machine backups, but you have to enable it. You need to go into the Time Machine preferences, and when you choose the Time Machine volume, you need to click the option that says Encrypt Backups, and then your Time Machine backups will be encrypted. For external cloned drives, I would say check with the clone software maker on their preferred method for encrypting those volumes. It may be a little bit different depending upon which software you're using. So usually on their support websites, they'll show you how to do that or tell you how to do that. For other just external drives that you use on a day-to-day basis, you can actually select those in the Finder and control click or right click on them and choose encrypt. And that will apply File Vault 2 encryption to those external volumes, but you have to do each volume separately. One thing to note if you choose to go that route though, is that external drives, when you connect them, they're not going to get decrypted during the boot process. You're gonna have to enter your credentials for each drive to get it to be decrypt each time you mount it. So that changes how things work when you start up your Mac. So be aware of that. You know, you're not going to be able to just auto mount them, and it's not going to use the credentials you used during login. You're going to have to log in or provide credentials for each encrypted drive that you're connecting to your Mac when you boot it up. You know, once it's up and running, you're fine. It'll continue to work normally, but next time you reboot, you're going to have to enter those credentials again. And then as far as offsite backups go, that encryption of that data should be happening at your backup service. So if your backup service is not encrypting your data or providing encryption, get another backup service. And they're a sponsor here on the MacCast, but I can highly recommend Backblaze for that. They do encrypt all of that data on the server side. And you know, a lot of these services will also have the option where you can keep the keys, they can have the keys, and so you can again determine and decide how much privacy, how much security you want to have. But just knowing that if you choose to generate your own keys and use your own keys on those offsite backups, that once again you lose those keys or you forget your logins, they're not going to be able to help you recover your data. So you have to weigh those pluses and minuses on your own. So a few other last things to talk about. If you are logged into your machine, I already pointed this out, the data is in an unencrypted state. So the reason I bring this up is that I would advise that you make sure that you require a password to access your Mac when your Mac goes to sleep or your Mac goes to using a screensaver. And you can set this up pretty easily. You can go into System Preferences, Security and Privacy, and you can check the option that says require a password after sleep or screensaver begins. And you can set a period of time for that. I have mine set to go immediately. So when my Mac goes to sleep, you cannot bring it out of sleep mode without entering in my password. And this is really important. You need to be using very secure, good login passwords, because once again, imagine the scenario. You're out someplace, you've let your Mac go to sleep, you've walked away. Just because you have File Vault 2 encryption on, if your Mac is open and accessible and you're logged into your account, anybody can access your data. And even with the screen password set, the data is not encrypted, right? You've just provided a layer of protection, security for getting in. The data encryption happens when you've shut down your Mac completely or you're not logged into your user account. So once you've done that, then it's back in its encrypted state and you're good to go. So I just want to be very, very clear about that. So by that token, if you want even more security, you can go into the security and privacy settings under System Preferences and you can click on the Advanced button. And in there, you can set your Mac to log out completely after a certain number of minutes of inactivity. There's an option for that. But what you need to keep in mind with this option is that if you have automated backups, like clone backups that run on schedules at certain times, they're not going to run because guess what? You're logged out of your account. Your disk is encrypted and those services and those backup programs don't have access to your data either. So they're not going to be able to be backed up. So just a few little sticking points and things to be aware of if you've enabled File Vault 2 encryption. So, you know, what are some of the other advantages of using and enabling File Vault 2? One, I already mentioned the ability to track your Mac with Find My Mac. and know that your data is secure. Another cool feature with Find My Mac is you have the ability to remote erase your drive, and that erasure is going to happen immediately. Without File Vault 2, what it's going to do is it's going to issue a command to the remote Mac, and it's going to have to start erasing the volume, which, depending upon the size of the volume, can take some time. With whole disk encryption enabled, File Vault 2 enabled, what it does is it simply revokes and deletes the key, the encryption keys that are on the Mac. And at that point, that means there's no way to decrypt the data by anybody, even you. So once you get your Mac back, if you do, and you've chosen to erase it through Find My Mac, just be aware that you're going to have to completely erase the volume, restore the operating system, and then restore from any backups that you have. You're not going to be able to get back at your data once you've told Find My Mac remotely to erase that volume. So be aware of that. You know, it's obviously a last ditch effort. It's a doomsday scenario. So you think, hey, I'm never getting my Mac back. I want to be 100% sure that no one can crack in and access my data. You delete it, it revokes the key, and you're good to go. And that process happens almost instantaneously, unlike just doing a remote erase, which is going to take a certain amount of time. And if someone realizes what you're doing, they could simply disconnect from the internet or you know, halt that process, and then still potentially gain access to your data. So, you know, I think File Vault 2 has a lot of advantages. I have had no issues using it. I know there are people out there who have and refuse to use it. The original version of File Vault was terrible. It was really bad. It had a lot of issues, but I think it's come a long way since. So I guess the last question I often get asked is, who should use File Vault 2? I think it's a good idea if you're really concerned about the security and privacy of the data on your Mac, and especially if you have a portable Mac, something that is leaving your house, is something that you could potentially lose control of, that somebody could potentially gain access to from outside your house. But I mean, even with a desktop Mac, you know, knock on wood that it never happens to you, but if someone were to break into your house and steal your Mac, they're going to have your data. Now, by that same token, I have to admit that I do not use File Vault encryption on some of my cloned external drives. I've considered it, but I just feel like they don't leave my home. They're relatively secure, and I've made that personal choice that I don't worry as much about that data as the data on my MacBook Pro, which, you know, I could be at a Starbucks and somebody rips off, or it's in my car when I'm traveling around and someone breaks into my car and steals it. So again, these are all personal choices to make, but I did want to get in and have this conversation because, again, going back and forth with Rick, I thought there was a lot of questions and things related to File Vault 2 that I get asked a lot that we really hadn't talked about too much here on the MacCast, at least not recently. So hopefully this helps some people out. If you have opinions and thoughts on File Vault 2, if you have experiences you want to share and reasons why or why not, you know, why you do or why you don't use File Vault 2, feel free to share those. Shoot me an email, send me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information, details, and check out all their great software by going to smilesoftware.com/podcast. I also want to say a quick thanks to all of my new supporters on Patreon. I have started up a Patreon campaign. If you like what you hear on the MacCast, if you want to give some direct monetary support, a great way to do that is pledge your support on patreon.com/MacCast. We have some rewards that are up there at certain levels. At the very least, at every level, you can get access to the MacCast Slack channel. We have a growing community in there, a bunch of people having great conversations, trying to help each other out with Mac issues and problems and just general discussion. I'm in there almost every day. So if you want to ask me a question directly, you can reach me through the MacCast Slack channel. And again, you get access to that as a Patreon supporter. And you can you can pledge your support at any level from a dollar on up to whatever amount you want. And all of that money goes directly back into supporting the day-to-day operations of the MacCast. So it covers my costs and expenses and things like that. And I really appreciate everybody who has pledged their support. It's been great. And thank you all. And another great way to support the MacCast is just go on iTunes and give us a review. If you can give us a quick review, a star rating, something like that, that goes a long way into helping out our rankings on iTunes. And keeping up in the rankings is a good way for other new members to find our community and become participants in the MacCast. So thanks everybody for that. Again, check out the Patreon, patreon.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. I love your comments, your questions. If you have something you want to ask me about, if you want to mention a topic you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline, that phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, you can check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/PlusMacCast. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.